So, all right, I'll be talking about St. Patrick today, a man who, in a few days, our most people in our nation will honor by getting wasted and eating green food. But St. Patrick was an incredible man of God who radically changed Ireland. And what he did in Ireland changed the fate of Europe, and what happened in Europe affects us to this day. It's incredible, the stuff that this guy did. And so, probably a year and a half ago, I picked up this book called How the Irish Saved Civilization by Thomas Cahill. I saw the title and I was like, that sounds cool. How the Leprechaun Saved the World? Gotta read it. So I picked it up. It's like 400 or 500 pages just talking about what St. Patrick did and then all the stuff that happened because of him. And that stirred up this desire throughout the past year to read more books, articles, watch videos, listen to sermons talking about the history of St. Patrick. It's just fascinating. I filled my mind with way too much stuff. And so I thought, all right, I got to share something. Last year, actually, I wanted to share stuff when I knew less. But now I'm like, I got to share stuff this around St. Patrick's Day or I'll just explode. I thought I could fit it into one sermon. And then I'm like, yeah, no, it's going to be two. I think it's going to be two. I don't really want to do three sermons about St. Patrick. But if you want it, let me know. I think just next week I'll finish it up. Psalm 77, verse 11. This is the only Bible I've got today. Well, I'll be referencing the Bible, but this is the only verse that I have for you today. So soak it up, guys. I told Cosette that I only had one Bible verse this week, and she said, well, it's good you had at least one, Daddy. So then I had to ask her, well, why do you say that? And she's like, because it must have been very hard work to get that one verse. Said it was. And I hope the people in our church understand what I went through to get this one verse for you. I don't know what's in that girl's head most of the time. Yeah. All right. So, Psalm 77, verse 11. I will remember the deeds of the Lord. Yes, I will remember your wonders of old. I will ponder all your work and meditate on your mighty deeds. Your way, O God, is holy. What God is great like our God? You are the God who works wonders. You have made known your might among the peoples. Now, I went to college for engineering, and then I got saved and switched to history because history was a lot easier than engineering, and I didn't want to spend that much time in class. I wanted to get out preaching on the streets and going to church and Bible studies and stuff. But as a history major, I grew to really love history, love the story of what people have done. And more than that, I was a Christian when I was a history major studying history. I would see what God did. And I was going to UW-Madison, secular university, so they weren't, you know, talking about what St. Patrick did or other Christians. But I knew some of the church history, and then we have this in-house Bible school, Solid Rock, and I was taking church history classes through that. And so I was linking stuff up, going, oh, sweet, this was happening in the secular world while the First Great Awakening was happening, or while Peter Cartwright was ministering and preaching. And so linking things up and seeing God, through studying history, God gave me a real appreciation for his hand throughout history and seeing what he's done, and that he has a plan, and he raises people up to accomplish his plan, and he's never defeated. And even though there's been dark times throughout history, God's not surprised. He's never been surprised. He's never been overwhelmed and gone, oh, communism, what the heck? Where did that come from? No, he's already got things set up where he's going, all right, fine, I'll let you guys rule for 40, 50 years, but I got my people that are going to topple it. Don't worry. And St. Patrick is one of those guys where he came around in a very dark time, but God used him to do incredible things. And so we got to, you know, I'm shocked nowadays how our nation in particular, but other nations as well, but our nation in particular, we don't look at history. We don't understand history. We don't look at church history. We don't know the impact that God has made on our nation or on the nations of the world. And we don't know the great men and women of our past, what's happened, or the evil men and women of the past. You go to college students, show them pictures of Stalin and Lenin and Trotsky and all these guys are like, oh, who's that? I don't know. We've got to look at history. We've got to know history, know especially what has God done in history. And that, for me, that stirs up my faith. And so we're going to talk about St. Patrick and the guys and some of his disciples over the next couple of weeks. So St. Patrick when really all I knew about them before VeggieTales made their thing about St. Patrick, all I knew was green beer and people getting drunk, and I'm like, why is he a saint? That doesn't make sense. Then VeggieTales did their little spiel while years ago, and I thought, oh, he was a missionary, went to Ireland. Oh, that's cool. And they worship trees and plants, and now they worship God. Oh, that's cool. And that's really all I knew until I started really looking into it. And so I think you're going to learn a lot, and I hope you get inspired over the next couple weeks. So St. Patrick was born around 385 AD. We're not certain on the exact year, but around there. And he died 461 AD. He was not born Patrick. He was actually born, his real name is Maewyn Sukat. He started being called Patrick when he became a priest. The word Patrick, so when he was a priest, they called him in Latin Patricius Maewyn. Patricius means father in Latin. So he was Father Maewyn, Patricius Maewyn, and we call him St. Patrick because of the Latin word for father, because he was a priest. But his real name was Maewyn Sukat. He was born in the Roman province of Britannia, which is modern-day England. He comes from a upper middle-class family. His grandfather was a priest in the Roman Catholic Church, and at the time, the priests in the Roman Catholic Church were the upper elite in society. They had power, they had money, they had connections. And so his grandfather was a Roman Catholic priest. His father was a Roman tax collector, a curialis. And that title, Patrick had a right to take that title for his father to pass it on to him. But Patrick chose not to for a number of reasons. But he ended up selling the title instead, and somebody else got stuck collecting Roman taxes. Early in life, so Patrick's family was not very religious, Patrick in particular. They attended church irregularly, but they weren't really Christian. They cultural Christian, they go once in a while, but they were not particularly religious at all. There's some scandal that happened early on, while he was young, before 16 years old. There was some scandal that happened. Historians aren't sure what it was. It was big enough that it shocked his family, shocked the church world around him, especially later in life when Patrick became a priest. People used that scandal against him. A lot of historians think that he murdered one of the family servants. They're not entirely certain, but it was a big deal, whatever he did. He was not living a godly life. In 401 AD, the Irish slave traders invaded England, not really invaded, they came by night in England and raided villages and hauled off captives. The Irish were known for this. They were feared throughout Europe as slave traders. In 401 AD, they did one of their biggest slave raids ever. They captured over 1,000 slaves from England, all children, Patrick among them. Patrick was 16 at the time. He was a captive, kidnapped, brought over to Ireland, sold as a slave to a man who we don't know much about him other than he had a lot of land and he had a lot of sheep. And Patrick was out in the hills by himself for the next 6 years taking care of these sheep. He rarely saw another human being. And so he wrote about being so lonely out there because he wouldn't see people. He's just taking care of these sheep that he got very depressed, very lonely. He forgot how to speak English properly and how to write and understand English after so long just hanging out with sheep that don't speak English very well. I could say by experience, our sheep did not speak English very well when we were living on the farm. We tried. he forgot English, he started struggling with English, and he also never really learned Irish because the sheep also did not speak Irish, oddly enough. So he's out there by himself. He'd see Irish people once in a while, but mostly just by himself with these sheep for 6 years. And at that time, he got very depressed, very lonely, and he began crying out to God. And it's then when he gave his heart to God and started developing this relationship with God, just him by himself, you know, with God, with the sheep, nobody else to talk to, Jesus became very close to him. He started to recognize the voice of God and develop this strong relationship. He wrote about it later so there's a few writings that we have by St. Patrick. The main one is called St. Patrick's Confession. He wrote this because later in life, people were criticizing him because of his past, because of the scandal from his past. They were criticizing him for that, and they were criticizing him. Nobody wanted to go to Ireland, yet Patrick's going to Ireland. And so there were people going, why are you going? You got some shady deal with the slave traders? You are selling off, you know, baptism, promising they get to go to heaven for, you know, they pay you money to get baptized, go to heaven. What's going on here, buddy? So he wrote his confession just to say, look, this is why I went. This is what I'm doing. This is who I am. And in that confession, he writes there about his experience with the sheep. He says, I was like a stone lying in deep mire, and he that is mighty came and in his mercy raised me up, and indeed lifted me high up and placed me on top of the wall. And from there I ought to shout out in gratitude to the Lord for his great favors in this world and forever that the mind of man cannot measure. So for 6 years he's out there with the sheep, but God uses it for good. He ends up drawing Patrick to himself, and Patrick gets born again, develops a relationship with God. Well, in 407 AD, after 6 years, Patrick's about 22 years old. He escaped from slavery. And how that happened was one night Patrick had a dream that he hears a voice say, your hungers are rewarded. You are now going home. So he, bam, he suddenly wakes up, sits up in bed. He's like, that was weird. And then he hears an audible voice say to him, look, your ship is ready. So Patrick, without skipping a beat, just gets up, packs his couple things, and starts walking to the shore. He has no idea where he is or how to get to the shore. It's enemy territory. If anybody sees him, they'll recognize him as a slave, and they'll recognize that he's not Irish. He's English. And what is an Englishman doing in Ireland? Awaiting to be kidnapped and sold into slavery. And so he has to go through enemy territory, walk 200 miles in enemy territory that he's never seen before, in the midst of fierce warring clans. And he's got a number, he's a marked man, that anybody could just capture him at any moment and sell him back into slavery again. But he does it. He just gets up, walks 200 miles, gets to the shore. At the shore, he sees a captain with a boat, and talks to the man and says, I need to get back to England. And the captain doesn't want to take him because he realizes you're a fugitive slave. If I take you, that will cause problems for me. And so he's like, no, we're not going to do it. And so Patrick, he's discouraged, and doesn't know what to do, so he goes back into the village, finds a little hut that he ends up sitting in, and just praying and like wondering what is going to happen. And then he starts, you know, he even wrote about it in his confessions that he was worried that the captain maybe would report him to somebody else, and boom, he's back into slavery. Or the captain would decide, free Irish slave, let's take him. But then somebody comes to the hut and says, all right, we talked about it, come on board, we'll take you. So and for free. So they take him on the boat and they make their journey back to England. But here it gets a little bit confusing. It took them 3 days to go from Ireland to continental Europe. I don't know why it took them so long. It should have just been quick, but maybe they made some stops on the way. But in 3 days they get to continental Europe, and then they were met with devastation and destruction everywhere. At this time, there were Germanic barbarian tribes that would routinely come into the Roman Empire and just loot and pillage, lay waste to everything they saw, burn fields, burn houses, destroy whatever they saw, take whatever they wanted. And people would flee in the face of that because they're barbarians. You don't want to see that. So they get to Europe and they just see destruction everywhere. They didn't see any people. There were no crops, no fruit trees. No wild animals for them to eat, no domesticated animals. It's like the whole population had left in the face of these barbarian tribes, and the tribes had burned down and destroyed everything. And so for some accounts say 2 weeks, other accounts say 4 weeks, they were wandering through Europe trying to get, well, Patrick trying to get home, everybody else, I don't know what they were doing, the captain and his crew. And after a while, they ran out of provisions. They had no food, and they couldn't find any food anywhere, and all the crops and everything was ruined. And so the captain turns to Patrick, and he goes, hey, you're a Christian, right? Patrick says, yeah, I'm a Christian. Well, what's wrong with you? Why aren't you praying for us? Can't your God provide for you? We're out of food. Come on, pray, make your God provide something. And he hassles Patrick. So Patrick goes, all right, well, if you really believe and you trust God, he'll provide food for us, and he'll provide it today, more food than you could possibly imagine, and more than you could even eat today. So he gathers everybody around, these pagan Irish people who don't believe in God and himself, they gather together and they pray that God would do a miracle. As they're praying, suddenly this herd of pigs comes rushing through the streets of the village at them. So they had all the bacon that you could desire. But I can desire a lot of bacon, so maybe not. So they get this miracle bacon on legs, and they had enough food then. That night, something strange happened with St. Patrick. He went down to sleep, and he wrote about that he felt this demonic presence come over him. He said it was Satan himself. I don't know if Satan himself would go visit Patrick or just send a terrifying demon. Probably just send a demon. But Patrick is tormented. He writes about being tormented that night by this oppressive demonic force, presence, that came upon him and just started pressing him down and terrifying him. And then suddenly he cries out to God, and something happened that, you know, I look at it and I'm like, he might have got filled with the Spirit at that moment. Like, he talks about, well, here, I'll write what he says. So as he cries out to God for deliverance, it says, "Suddenly the splendor of the sun fell on me and immediately freed me of all misery. And I believe that I was sustained by Christ my Lord and that his Spirit was even then crying out in my behalf." Sounds to me like he's being oppressed by the enemy. He cries out to God. God comes down in his presence, delivers him from that demonic power, floods him with his presence, his Spirit, and then he started speaking out in tongues. That's what it seems like to me. The Spirit crying out in my behalf, he wrote. So whatever happened, though, it was a powerful experience for him. And then the next day, they go back on their journeys, Patrick trying to get back to England. The other guys, not sure what they're doing. Maybe looking for slaves to bring back to Ireland. And at some point, he's captured again by a different slave raiding party. So he gets captured by somebody else, put back into slavery. But the first night of that, God speaks to him and says, "You will be released in 60 days. 60 days later, he's free. He doesn't give any details on how that exactly happened. And then Patrick ends up wandering through Europe for another few years, before he gets back home to England. We're not sure what actually happened there. Some people say he went to seminary in France and became a priest. Patrick himself said that he was not educated and that he never learned Latin or Greek, and he's very clear about that. If you go to seminary, you're probably going to learn Latin or Greek. But he might have gone to seminary, might have not. Somehow, while he's wandering, wandering through Europe, he did become a priest. So some people say he went to seminary. Others say that he had just had a connection with someone who said, "Well, you clearly have a call from God. Okay, you can be a priest." We don't know exactly what happened, but he ends up becoming a priest, gets back home to England, and even the rest of that journey, Patrick told stories about them running out of food again, and then miraculously on the last day of their provisions, somebody showed up with exactly the amount of food they need for the next trip, and then somebody else shows up with more food. So God kept providing for them. Then he gets back home to England. His family hasn't seen him in years, and so they're excited, they're happy to have him. They want him to stay, and he's a priest now, so he could get a cushy job as a Roman Catholic priest. So the family wants him to stay. They say this would be good for you. It's good employment, and you're with us. We've missed you. It'd be nice to have you around. God had other plans. Patrick has another dream shortly after arriving at home. He sees a letter arrive, and that's labeled "The Voice of the Irish." He opens it up, and he hears, said, like, "The voice of a multitude of Irishmen crying out, 'We beg you, holy boy, come and walk among us once more.'" And so he wakes up. And he wrote that he was stabbed in his heart, and he knew, "I have to go to Ireland, but not now, not as a slave. Now I'll go as a missionary to preach the gospel." So he decides that's what he's going to do. All right, let's pause there for a little bit, and I want to give you some of the background, what was going on in the Roman Empire at the time, in the church world, and in Ireland at the time, just because I want you to get it how this was a big deal. For Patrick to go become a missionary in Ireland, it was a really big deal, and I want you to get that. So the Roman Empire at the time stretched throughout the Mediterranean world. It was at about its peak, but it was on the decline. The Roman Empire had gotten into Great Britain. England was a part of the Roman Empire. Spain in the southwest. To the east, Turkey, parts of Romania, and I guess in the south, Egypt. So the Roman Empire spread all throughout the Mediterranean world, but they were on the decline, and around the Roman Empire, to the outskirts, especially to the north, northeast, the north and the northeast, there were Germanic barbarian tribes that were starting to invade Rome. Some were just moving in and settling and starting to take overwhelm the Roman infrastructure. Others were just coming in to loot and pillage, and every couple months or a couple years, you'd have another tribe come in and take over a city, and then they'd leave, and then the Romans would take it over again. So there was, Rome was on the decline, but they still were, had a lot of land. The church, the situation was interesting. The church by this time, so the church, Christianity had been legal for about 100 years, and numerically the church was dominant in the Roman Empire. It had spread to every corner of the Roman Empire. Every major city had at least one church in it. Christianity was a dominant faith by, in terms of the numbers, the percentage of believers. Paganism was on the decline. Where are my notes here? Christian holidays were replacing pagan holidays. Christians were in high government positions. As an overall culture, things were becoming, they were established as Christianized, in a sense. People started to think in Christian ways, name their kids Christian names. Pagan culture was on the, was leaving. But this was, the church was very lukewarm, very corrupt, very tied to politics. There had been no concentrated missionary effort, as far as we know, from the evidence we have, since basically the time of Paul and the early disciples. The church had spread to the cities in particular, and had become like the main religion that had political power and had influence. Emperor Constantine was the first to declare that Christianity was legal, and so it started to dominate politics and everything, started to dominate the economic life. So cities were dominated by Christians. Politics was dominated by Christians. But there were few missionaries going to the countryside. Few ministers even visited the countryside. Even the Apostle Paul, you know, his strategy was go to the main cities, which, smart thinking, you want to get the most people with your message, and people gather in the cities. And so Paul went to the main cities. A lot of the early Christians went to the main cities. There were very few that went to the countryside. And as a result, through the years, the countryside continued to be rather pagan. Even the word pagan goes back to the Latin word for country dweller, or someone who lives in the countryside. It was paganus. So the countryside became associated with pagans. Which, Terry and Diane, why are you guys living so far out in the countryside? No, you guys are good. So you had this situation where the church is growing numerically, but it's largely in the cities. The countryside is not being impacted. There's people that went to the countryside. Augustine went to the countryside, but he wrote about that he would never go back because he got beat up in the countryside. So there was this mentality that stick to the cities, the countryside does their thing, they're pagans, we're not going to go reach them. There was no effort to try, well, at least our evidence shows that there was no effort. I'm sure there were guys that went. God always is sending people. But for a large part, the church was focused on the cities, but the countryside was not being reached, and a lot of people said, don't go to the countryside, it's not worth your time. And then beyond the countryside, no one was going to the barbarian tribes. There were few that even thought about it, and then even some priests and bishops openly said, don't waste your time, they're beyond hope, they're beyond reaching the gospel. It would be a waste of time to take the glorious gospel of God and give it to these barbarians that wouldn't understand. And so you had the church dominant in the Roman Empire, dominating especially in the cities, very influential, but the countryside, no one was going to the countryside, and no one was going to the barbarian tribes. In addition to that, so you had the church was in the city, where, and the cities is where the money is, where the money is where the politicians are. The church became very connected with the Roman politics. Priests and bishops, were official Roman, officers of the Roman government, officially appointed to their positions by this point in a lot of places. People sought out the title, the position of being a priest or a bishop, not generally for some high calling from God, but because they saw, wow, this would be a really cushy office. I could get money, I could get influence, I could get power, I could have connections, and I don't have to do that much, so yeah, make me a priest. So you have guys that were buying office, the title of priest and bishop. The church had become organized on Roman political lines. The bishoprics, the area of jurisdiction that each bishop would have, was exactly following the Roman city and country county administrators. They had the same, like you had a city official who had his jurisdiction here, and then the church said, all right, well, we'll put a bishop exactly on the same jurisdiction. The word for that area of jurisdiction in Latin is diocesis, where we get the word diocese from. It was very connected with the church and the Roman political elites were intertwined together. The church largely stayed where there was Roman political power, where the Roman politics, where Roman law reigned and had authority. In the Roman world, they talked about two different worlds. There was one world where Roman law had jurisdiction, and that was called ecumene. That's where the church went, in the ecumene, where we get the word ecumenical from. The church and the Roman political ruling elite were completely intertwined. The church had no thought of ever going outside the ecumene, ever leaving Roman political power, because they required that. They needed the support. Well, they thought they did. They thought, we need the support of the Roman political elite. We need the Roman government. We need the Roman laws. We need in order to do the work of God. And so they wouldn't go outside the ecumene. They wouldn't go to the countryside and go to the paganus. They wouldn't go to the barbarians where Roman power was nothing. So you had the church was numerically spreading throughout the Roman Empire. It was blessed. It was prosperous in a lot of ways, but it was very hollow, very empty, very dry religious tradition, very corrupt, very tied to politics. And at the same time, a lot of false teaching started to arise. In the 400s, the idea of confession to a priest arose. It started as a good idea. Priests started talking about, hey, if you have sin, find a brother or sister in the Lord and confess your sin to them, pray together, and you'll be encouraged and strengthened. They'll be encouraged and strengthened. Great idea. It's biblical. It's a good thing. If you have sin, talk to someone and get some help and pray together. Well, it went from that to then priests saying, well, if you really want help, you go to the priest. And then, well, when you go to the priest, it's not just that you'll confess and he talks it over with you and prays for you. He actually forgives you and he absolves you of your sin. So around this time, there were the teaching of that a priest can absolve you of your sin. That started to invade the Christian church, which, you know, it's Catholic, but at the time that was all there was. So there was Christianity was numerically numerous, but it was very, for the most part, corrupt, lukewarm, mixed with politics, not zealous for evangelism, no missionary thrust at all, and giving way to a lot of heretical kind of beliefs and wrong teaching. So that was the state of the church at the time. Ireland was a wild, crazy, barbaric place. So St. Patrick, he's a Roman citizen. He's born in a civilized Roman district, Britannia province. And God calls him to go to Ireland. Ireland was not Roman. Ireland was not civilized. It wasn't a part of the ecumene. They were paganus. They were country dwellers, pagans living over there. It was Romans viewed them as backwards, immoral people. Who drank way too much and did perverse things that the Romans would never do because that's beneath us. Except a few hundred years ago, you guys were doing exactly that. So Ireland was outside the ecumene. It wasn't a part of Roman law, Roman jurisdiction at all. It was more like, as I've read about Ireland at the time, it was more like Vikings. You know, if you the Norse Vikings going in, like terrible, fierce warriors. That's what the Irish were like. Not Lucky Charms kind of stuff. No rule of law. It was might makes right for the most part. You had different warring tribes. You know, one guy would rise up. He'd have more sheep so people would respect him more, or he happened to have a better sword, or he's a little bit stronger, so he would take authority in this area, and then another warlord over there. So there was no real law other than whoever's the most powerful, he's going to make the laws to benefit himself. There were no cities or population centers at the time. there were just scattered settlements. You had a guy with his farm or his ranch with sheep or cattle over here. You had a guy and his couple people from his family over there, a few people over there. Just scattered farms and settlements all throughout the area. No main cities, which is would have been hard for a missionary to go to because missions had always gone where the cities were. That's what Christianity had done for 400 years. You go to the cities. Well, Ireland didn't have cities. Irish culture was dark and violent. They were entirely illiterate at the time. It was an oral society. They passed down epic poems. One generation to the next would pass down these epic poems orally. And they're just brutal, violent, disturbing poems about, you know, bloodshed and immorality, just real freaky caveman pagan kind of stuff. Irish warfare was constant and intense. They went to battle naked, carrying nothing but a shield and a sword, like a Braveheart-sized sword, those big two-handed ones. That was the Irish warriors. Thomas Cahill, in his book, writes, the Romans, in their first encounters with these exposed, insane warriors, were shocked and frightened. Not only were the men naked, they were howling, and, it seemed, possessed by demons. So outrageous was their strength and verve. Urged on by the infernal skirl of pipers, they presented to the unaccustomed Romans a multimedia event featuring all the terrors of hell itself. The Roman soldiers wrote about how horrific these Irish and Celt warriors were at the time. They weren't used to that. They were very ordered, they had their way, their systematic way of doing war, and then they met these crazed barbarians that just were out of their minds. So warfare was intense and constant. Slavery was a part of life in Ireland. The Irish were feared throughout Europe as slave traders. Everybody knew the Irish are going to come. They're going to try to kidnap people. And what they would do is the Irish had these boats that they could be very quiet in these boats. They would come ashore quietly, so nobody, you know, in the middle of the night, they go to these settlements, sneak in quietly so nobody would see them, find houses and take little kids while they're sleeping on their beds. That's what the Irish would do. Sexual immorality was rampant. There were few restrictions or inhibitions at all. They held marriage was, when you got married with somebody, they gave you a 1-year trial marriage. Just in case, you know, you want to try it out, see if it's for you or not. So you do 1 year, and then after the year, you're allowed to separate and find someone else for a year and see how that goes. And then also, every February 1st, everybody could just get divorced and remarry somebody else. It was part of their laws, their customs. Multiple partners, homosexuality, grotesque, disturbing, immoral public acts that would shock you. And I'm not going to talk about them. They were so gross. Jesse knows. I told my wife about them. I'm like, oh, that's nasty, you Irish people. I'm Irish. So is Jesse. We're both. We have some, but we don't do that. In terms of religion, Christianity was non-existent. Missionaries were not going there. Their religion was, they were led by druid sorcerers. They worshipped shape-shifting gods and goddesses of war, violence, immorality, gods of nature. These gods were terrifying. There's a story told of Nemain and Badb. I don't know how to pronounce it. B-A-D-B, Badb. War goddesses that, so they said that these goddesses would come as the Irish soldiers made war with one another, these goddesses would come and terrify the soldiers so that they would die in their sleep at night and not be able to battle the next day. One of their poems says that these two warring factions had gathered together and they went to sleep for the night before the battle the next day. And it says that Nemain and Badb called out to the men of Ireland near the field at Garrick and Eargarrick, and 100 warriors died of fright. It was a bad night for them. Yeah, bad night. 100 soldiers died. So that was their gods. They worshiped these violent, terrifying gods. When you look at the literature and stuff that comes out of Ireland at the time, it's filled with fear, intense fear, fear of death. Warlords could just kill you for no reason at any time, just because they're more powerful than you are. The gods could kill you. Often in their poetry, the gods did. They killed you just out of spite or out of pure sadistic pleasure. They feared falling asleep. They would talk about these gods that would come and just kill you in your sleep. So they were afraid of falling asleep. And so a lot of the poetry talks about the only way that people would fall asleep was if they got drunk before they, otherwise they just lay awake at night terrified. There was a fear of the world. They taught that, you know, gods could shapeshift, druids could shapeshift. So you go, you imagine you're an Irish guy, you go out hunting, you see a deer over there, you're like, oh, right. And then suddenly, you know, you fire the arrow, it hits him, and suddenly the guy turns into a druid and he puts a curse on you. That's what they would do in their poetry, their myths that they talk about. The gods would do it too. The gods would, like, all of a sudden you're hiking in the woods and then suddenly some god appears from behind a tree, or he was a tree and he turns into a god and he's like, ha ha, I got you now. And then boom, you're dead. Or often the gods would give ridiculous commandments to people. There's a story of one guy that wanted to become king, and so a god appears to him. I think it was the god was disguised as a rock or a crow or something in nature anyway. And he appears to him and says, I will bless you. I will make you a king. And the guy's like, great, awesome. But be careful. You have to follow these commandments. And if you don't follow these, I will curse you and your family forever. And the commandments were ridiculous. Things like he couldn't go into a he couldn't be in a building that had windows, and if he couldn't leave a building when there were three people with red hair within sight of the building, he couldn't have women on his left side anywhere walking. It was like 15 different rules like this that were just ridiculous. So the god said, "If you don't do these, you will be cursed." So in addition to a fear of the world, fear of sleeping, fear of death, there was an intense fear of the gods. God was not someone to love, someone to follow, someone to respect. It was someone to be terrified of. The gods were something to be terrified of because they might just show up and curse you forever. Thomas Cahill writes, "They viewed the world as if it were a forest filled with concealed pitfalls by which hunter gods catch small animals. An important part of their religious practice was human sacrifice. They sacrificed prisoners of war to the gods of war to have victory. In war, they sacrifice their own brethren. If they're losing in battle or if they're about to go to war against someone, they want to be guaranteed victory. They find somebody in the clan and they sacrifice him to the god of war so that they can go in and kick butt. They sacrifice their newborn babies to the harvest gods. They would take their those who were sacrificed, they take their victims' heads, they display them in the temples, put them on their fort walls. They string them around their belts. They drink from their skulls and ceremonies. They played soccer with their heads. Disturbing, dark, wild, crazy, uncivilized place. That was Ireland. So for St. Patrick to go there was a big deal. It wasn't like, oh, sweet, I'll just go over there and see these nice people. No, it was terrifying. So when God calls him to go, he met with a lot of opposition. His family said, no, we don't want you to go to Ireland. That's a bad place. You'll be killed. You'll be hurt. You'll be tormented. Don't go to Ireland. The church didn't want him to go because the Irish were beyond hope. They were beyond saving. Friends, family members, everybody told him, don't go. It doesn't make sense to go. We don't go to the barbarians. We don't go to the countryside. They're hopeless. It's too dangerous. It's too dark. Don't go. Yeah, the sensible thing was for him to not go. But St. Patrick went because God called him to go. Okay, so when he went, and he writes in his confession, responding to the critics, he says, "We ought to fish well and diligently as the Lord exhorts. Hence it was most necessary to spread our nets so that a great multitude and throng might be caught for God and that there be clerics everywhere to baptize and exhort a people in need." For Patrick, it didn't matter. The danger didn't matter. The opposition, what made sense or didn't make sense, it didn't matter. He said, look, we need to reach the lost for Jesus. We're going. And if it's dark, Jesus is the light, and let's spread the gospel there. So the first thing he did, and it's hard to find exact accounts, detailed historical records on everything, but it appears that he arrived on Holy Saturday, the Saturday before Easter, because all the other Saturdays are so unholy, you know, but Holy Saturday. So he arrives on Holy Saturday, right before Easter, and at the time they had a tradition, and I don't know, maybe the Catholic Church still does it today, I don't know, but at the time they had what was called the Paschal Fire. Saturday night they would light a fire to symbolize Jesus coming as the light of the world into the darkness. So Patrick decided to light a massive bonfire on that Saturday night. He arrives in Ireland, he sees the Hill of Slain, S-L-A-N-E, not S-L-A-I-N, but S-L-A-I-N sounds more terrifying, so that's kind of works for Ireland. So he goes to the Hill of Slain, the highest hill for miles around, and he lights the Paschal fire up there. It has this big bonfire roaring. People could see it for miles around. Normally, this would not be that offensive of a thing to the Irish, but this time of year, it was the equinox. In Ireland at the time, during the equinox, their religious beliefs said that only the local warlords had a right to light fires. Everybody else, if you wanted a fire, you had to go to the warlord and you get some embers and then you go home, you light your fire, you cook on it, you put it out. Other times of the year, fine, light a fire wherever you want. But this time of year, you don't light fires. What does Patrick do? He lights a fire. And he doesn't just do it in secret. He goes to the highest hill around, lights this bonfire. People from miles around can see it. And so villagers gather around at the base of the hill, and one of the local warlords sends his emissary up to Patrick. You know, and everybody's thinking, they've been told, you don't do this because the gods will kill you. This is what the gods have said to do. The king, the warlord gets access to the fire. You don't get access during this time of the year. So they see Patrick do it. And so they're thinking, the gods are going to kill him. Well, the king sends his emissary up there to kill Patrick, do the job for the gods. Because if they don't get rid of Patrick, who's offending the gods and their idea, then the gods are going to pour their wrath out on them. So the king sends his emissary up there to confront Patrick and kill him. Well, Patrick shares the gospel with him. The emissary gets saved, goes back down, and he's like, hey, it's all good, guys. Everybody disperses. And then a local warlord named Deku ended up taking Patrick in. Basically, they realize, okay, he didn't die, and he seems okay, but just something's weird with this guy. So this local warlord, Deku, takes him under his wing, and Patrick shares the gospel with him. Deku ends up getting saved, getting baptized. His whole family got saved and baptized, and then he shares the gospel with his clan. The whole clan gets saved and baptized. Deku gives him a barn, one of his barns, to use as a base of operations. Patrick turns that into the first Irish church. And from there, he traveled throughout the land, going from village to village, family to family, preaching the gospel, seeing people get saved, seeing people baptized, seeing people won into brought into the ministry. That emissary that went up, the king's emissary that went up the Hill of Slain to confront Patrick and kill him, he got saved, and he ended up becoming the first bishop of Ireland that Patrick discipled. Everywhere Patrick went, he was faced with opposition, criticism, dangers, and yet everywhere he went, he preached the gospel and people responded. And the cool thing with Patrick, so at the time, the Roman Catholic Church had a lot of wrong teachings. Patrick didn't have as much of that. He seemed to have just a real desire for God, a real relationship with God. He didn't have all of the education that the other priests and bishops had, which, for better or worse, you know, some things for better, I think, because he didn't get the wrong teaching with it. There were still some goofy things that Patrick said and some things that we would disagree with nowadays, but man, the guy was fearless for God. He writes about it in his Confessions. I went to you, talking about the Irish, I went to you, Irish, and everywhere for your sake in many dangers, even to the farthest districts beyond which there lived nobody, and where nobody had ever come to baptize or to ordain clergy or to confirm the people. In their minds, yeah, the Roman Empire, the Roman world ended at Ireland. There's just ocean beyond that. They didn't know what lay beyond that. And Patrick's like, I went everywhere, to the furthest reaches of civilization, even to where it's not civilized, preaching the gospel. And everywhere he went, he faced persecution and opposition, dangers. He wrote, for daily I expect to be murdered or betrayed or reduced to slavery if the occasion arises, but I fear nothing because of the promises of heaven. For I have cast myself into the hands of Almighty God who reigns everywhere. As the prophet says, cast your burden on the Lord and he will sustain you. He went everywhere and it was in constant danger, and yet God continually protected him. He writes about being stuck in the crossfire between one warring tribe and another one. He writes about druid sorcerers that were trying to kill him because he's stealing their people. He writes about getting robbed, beaten, imprisoned. He writes about being tortured by local warlords for preaching the gospel. He was almost killed 12 different times while he ministered in Ireland. Surprisingly, though, there were no Irish martyrs. This is something interesting in the history of Christianity. Wherever Christianity goes for the first time, there's martyrs, except Ireland. To my knowledge, there's no other place that this has happened. But Ireland, they got opposition, they got persecution, they got beat up, they got imprisoned, but nobody was killed for the faith. people killed as a result of, here's a warring tribe, there's a warring tribe, and they're walking through and some people got killed. But no actual Christian martyrs, which is kind of interesting. Despite all the opposition, Patrick just gave his all for the Irish. He wrote in the Confessions, "If I have ever done anything worthwhile for the God I love, I ask that I might be allowed to die here in Ireland for his name with these converts and slaves, even if it means that I won't have a marked grave or that my body is torn apart piece by dogs or wild animals or that I serve as a meal for the birds of the air." His heart was for the Irish people. And here, as he went, he radically transformed Ireland. He's going everywhere, from village to village, family to family, home to home, sharing the gospel. People are getting saved. They're turning to God. They're changing. He was there for 29 years. He baptized over 120,000 Irishmen, planted 300 churches. That's all right, you know. Violence, murder, and intertribal warfare significantly declined because of his ministry. It didn't stop entirely, but it went like took a nosedive. Paganism almost vanished. The Druid sorcerers almost just, they lost their power. They lost their influence. A lot of them left the, what do you call it? Like, I don't want to call it the ministry. They left what they were doing. Left paganism. Human sacrifice, there is no evidence of human sacrifice after the time of Patrick. Education and literacy increased. They didn't know how to read or write. After Patrick, you know, for Christians, it's important to know how to read the Word of God. And so that was part of what Patrick talked, what he did. He helped them to learn how to read their own language and write in their own language. So because of Patrick, a desire for learning, suddenly comes into Ireland. Irish Christians started learning Greek, Latin, ancient Hebrew, started learning their own language as well. The slave trade completely vanished in Ireland. We're not sure if it happened during Patrick's years or shortly after. But because of Patrick's, the Irish were no longer slave traders. Just done. Thomas Cahill writes about Patrick. The first human being in the history of the world to speak out unequivocally against slavery. Patrick said some harsh things against slavery. He rebuked slave traders without fear, and he minced no words about it. There had been people that spoke out against slavery beforehand, and the Bible it gives a very progressive, in the right sense, view of slavery. It's not pro-slavery like the anti-Bible people want to say. And there were some early church fathers that spoke out against slavery. But St. Patrick, he was a fierce opponent of slavery. There's a story of Patrick had been going around preaching the gospel in these villages. A number of people got saved and baptized, and so then he decided, let's do a big feast together. So they gathered everybody together to have a big festival. Well, Caroticus, infamous warlord slaver, heard about the festival, and he thought, this would be a great time to get some slaves. And so they came, they attacked, they killed people, they killed people, and they took a lot of them as slaves as well. Well, Patrick hunted them down, confronts him, and he says here, "You sons of the devil, dripping with blood, you will perish with all the wicked at the judgment day of the Lord. I testify before God and his angels that it will be so unless you repent of this heinous deed and set free these captives." Then he called them dogs, sorcerers, murderers, and liars. An infamous warlord. Well, the guy listened. Caroticus was like, okay, sets him free. That's how Patrick was everywhere. And as Patrick preached the gospel, this crazed, demonic world changed radically. Thomas Cahill writes, "Ireland had been received into Christianity, which transformed Ireland into something new, something never seen before, a Christian culture where slavery and human sacrifice became unthinkable, and warfare, though impossible for humans to eradicate, diminished markedly." And then later he says, "These transformed warrior children of Patrick's heart lay down their swords of battle, flung away the knives of sacrifice, and cast aside the chains of slavery." The transformation of Ireland was remarkable, completely changed. It's an incredible story, St. Patrick, what he did. And as I close up, you know, I'm going to give you a little preview into next week. So this is incredible, right? That one man, through just following God and going to this really dangerous, disturbing place, ended up radically changing this nation. Well, the coolest part of the story, in my opinion, maybe some of you guys will like this week, but next week is the coolest part to me. I mean, Patrick was incredible, but what happens afterwards, after Patrick, he starts raising up these disciples. And then these disciples, after Patrick's gone, they start doing what Patrick did. And then you see this ripple effect going throughout Ireland, throughout England and the British Isles, through the rest of Europe, to the point where we're actually impacted today because of what St. Patrick did. So you never know what God will do through you as you minister for Him, as you go out for Him and share the gospel and stand in His truth. And know, you know, I think about like nowadays how encouraging it is to me that Patrick went into this dark world and the darkness changed because of the light. It's easy to give in to pessimism, and you look at just the insanity around us and how people are so confused, so given into sexual immorality, to depravity and sin, and they seem so deceived, and like they can't even see their deception, which I guess is why they're deceived. If you could see the deception, maybe you wouldn't want to be deceived anymore. But people, it seems so dark sometimes, and it's easy to get pessimistic and just go, well, you know, this is how it's going to be. We're gonna survive somehow. We'll make it to the end. No, Jesus is the light. If Jesus could change Ireland through one man, St. Patrick. And Patrick, he was uneducated. He didn't speak his own language well. He didn't speak Irish well. He didn't speak Greek, Latin, Hebrew. He didn't know any of that stuff. He went into this dangerous place that was very dark, and it wasn't in the Roman ecumene. They didn't have cities. It didn't make sense for him to go, but God told him to go, so he went and he faithfully ministered, and that nation was transformed. Who knows what God will do through your life? So I want to encourage you to be bold, be strong, don't back down, don't give in to fear, don't just give in to that pessimistic weenie kind of attitude that says, oh, woe is me, it's so hard, and I wish we could do that. Get out there and be bold. God, things have been a whole lot darker in the past. People have been a whole lot more messed up, stubborn, crazed out of their minds in the past. And if little St. Patrick could go and reach Ireland, you can go and reach your neighbors. You can be a light in the darkness. Let me read. I want to read for this poem here to finish up. This is called St. Patrick's Breastplate, we're not certain if St. Patrick wrote it or not. It came around the time of St. Patrick for sure. He might have written it, or it might have been another Irish Christian from St. Patrick or someone else that wrote it, but it definitely has the heart of St. Patrick. They said, I don't believe this, but they said that he would recite it and it gave him power to turn himself into a deer and escape attacks. So I'm going to read it. But you might not want to read it during hunting season. I don't know. I don't want to be held accountable for what might happen. All right. I arise today through a mighty strength, through the invocation of the Trinity, through belief in the threeness, through confession of the oneness of the Creator of creation. I arise today through the strength of Christ's birth with His baptism, through the strength of His crucifixion with His burial, through the strength of His resurrection with His ascension, through the strength of His descent for the judgment of doom. I rise today through the strength of the love of cherubim and the obedience of angels and the service of archangels and the hope of resurrection to meet with reward, in the prayers of patriarchs and the predictions of prophets, in the preaching of apostles and the faith of confessors, in the innocence of holy virgins, in the deeds of righteous men. I rise today through the strength of heaven, the light of the sun, the radiance of the moon, the splendor of fire, the speed of lightning, the swiftness of wind, the depth of the sea, the stability of the earth, the firmness of rock. I arise today through God's strength to pilot me, God's might to uphold me, God's wisdom to guide me, God's eye to look before me, God's ear to hear me, God's word to speak for me, God's hand to guard me, God's shield to protect me, God's host to save me from the snares of devils, from temptations of vices, from everyone who shall wish me ill afar and near. I summon today all these powers between me and those evils, against every cruel and merciless power that may oppose my body and soul, against incantations of false prophets, against black laws of pagandom, against false laws of heretics, against craft of idolatry, against spells of witches and smiths and wizards, against every knowledge that corrupts man's body and soul. Christ to shield me today against poison, against burning, against drowning, against wounding, so that there may come to me an abundance of reward. Christ with me, Christ before me, Christ behind me, Christ in me, Christ beneath me, Christ above me, Christ on my right, Christ on my left, Christ when I lie down, Christ when I sit, Christ when I arise, Christ in the heart of every man who thinks of me, Christ in the mouth of everyone who speaks of me, Christ in every eye that sees me, Christ in every ear that hears me. I arise today through a mighty strength, through the invocation of the Trinity, through belief in the threeness, through confession of the oneness of the Creator of creation. Be bold. Be courageous. You have the King of the earth living inside you. You have the light of the world upon you. There is nothing that can oppose you, no matter how evil it is around you, no matter how dark and confused and crazed the world might be. Arise in His power. Amen. Jesus, thank you for what you did through St. Patrick. Thank you for using him to radically transform a nation, to delete slavery, to decrease warfare, to bring hundreds of thousands into the kingdom of God. Jesus, thank you for confronting the darkness and bringing your light and your healing, your hope there. Father, thank you that that's the same thing that you've done all over the world throughout history, that it's not just some weird little blip in Ireland, but Lord, that's just your character, that the light always wins in the darkness. And Father, I thank you that the light will win in our lives, that no matter what evil is in us or around us, what evil might be in our nation, Jesus, that you overcome it. Your light is greater than the darkness. Father, I pray for us to have a boldness, a zeal for your kingdom, a grace to go to places that are terrifying, to go to places where others say, no, don't go there, stay away from that. A grace to love the unlovable, to approach those people that others say, they're not worth your time, they're crazed, they're not going to receive it. Lord, that we would have a zeal, a boldness, and a love that would go to those people and see them transformed for your kingdom. In Jesus'